Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery, a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
All right, we made a promise to the people, Adam, that we were going to come up with recipes for Tranya.
Yeah.
I am really proud of how close I got color-wise to what they
Look
show in
that.
This episode. It was a shot in the dark. I made this by mixing four ingredients that I'd never mixed in this particular way before. And when I poured it out of the shaker into my little glass here, I was delighted at how close I got.
So you were aiming for verisimilitude. You wanted the look.
I wanted the look, and it's a little different in the Carbamite maneuver than it is in the Picard episode that we see Tranya in.
Uh-huh.
And it also sent me in a different direction conception-wise, because in the Carbamite maneuver, Tranya is clearly punch. It's in a bowl with a ladle, and you ladle some Tranya into a glass, and you enjoy it.
My favorite detail of that moment is the shelf extending.
Yeah, the curtains draw, and the shelf kind of comes out. You can clearly you can sense the hand of the stagehand on that shelf.
And it's sloshing, Ben. Let's face it. Like, there's a lot of slosh going on in that punch bowl. Looks like a dangerous situation.
It's not a great storage system for a punch bowl full of Tranya. In the Picard episode, though, Tranya is in like a decanter.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a, and I think that you would never put a decanted like spirit in a punch bowl by itself. You would always make a cocktail out of it. So that's what I did. I stayed in my lane. I made a tiki drink. It's an even ratio drink. It is one part high proof rum. I used the Plantation 69% alcohol by volume high proof rum. Nice. I used Banane du Brésil. I used ginger liqueur, and I used lemon juice. So this is equal parts, 3/4 ounce of each of those.
Wow.
And it came out really, really close in color to what we saw in the episode.
That it looks great. I just wish you had a little mini punch bowl with it.
It fucking tastes great. I can't wait to make you one. I ran out of creme de banane making it, though.
Wow. I have not had creme de banane in a very long time. And I'm now thinking of the last time that I did. It was a big mistake. I went into a different direction with my Tranya, and it was based on the reaction that the people had drinking it, because there's that moment sort of out of the Princess Bride where you're wondering, is the Tranya poison?
You fell victim to one of the classic blunders.
Who's gonna drink it first?
The floor is lava, the Tranya is poison.
Yeah, it looks, the situation is fraught, but then Kirk drinks the Tranya, and he is delighted by its flavor. he is clearly, it's not just the look of a person who is happy that it's not poison. I believe that James Kirk thinks Tranya is delicious.
Yeah.
And so given that it's the late afternoon, given that I'm feeling a little bit draggy at the moment, I thought I would juice up the energy level and go for something with a lot of oomph and a lot of delicious flavor. So I made myself a giant double espresso martini. And I've got it in my insulated mug right here. If you haven't made one of these, fairly simple to do. Shot of espresso, shot of vodka, and then an amount of a sweetened liqueur to your specific flavor. A lot of these you'll see out there are a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio, but I'll back off on the liqueur down by like half. So what I did is I used a half of a shot of pecan liqueur that I picked up in Nashville, actually.
Cool. Well, we must drink, Adam. I hope you relish it as much as I.
Cheers to you.
Every time Star Trek pulls out the word relish, it's really funny.
Yeah.
Relish in your Tranya.
Yeah, the only thing... I mean, it always sounds threatening too, even though on the page, it's very nice.
Yeah, yeah, and in the performance.
Right. Well, we are here to do a thing that we do occasionally on The Greatest Discovery, which is go back into the Star Trek archive, see if we can't learn anything about modern Star Trek by going into the past, and specifically, I'm talking about the original series shows, and today. We have chosen the season one episode of the original series of Star Trek. It's called The Corbomite Maneuver.
This episode opens, ship flying through space, and there is a fucking unbelievable shot from like the rafters above the set of the bridge where it zooms out from an ECU on Spock's finger punching a button back in the back of the ship. To a wide shot where you can see almost the entire bridge. Like this, the zoom goes from like 300 millimeters to like 30 millimeters on the lens. And then back to 300 millimeters as it zooms in on the hand of Lieutenant Bailey. Dave, they call him, around the bridge.
I love this sequence, Ben. I loved it as much as you did. You know that there is a camera person fucking struggling.
Yeah.
To do this. It really looks like work.
Just thinking about like the like lens gearing on a lens that can do a shot like this.
Right.
Like there's probably like a whip that some camera assistant has to like swing all the way around, like a 270 degree swing.
If there's no whip, it is a very complicated hand job kind of maneuver on this lens to get that gearing to go that far.
Fucking great shot.
Yeah.
Like really caught my attention. And just, I don't know, man, like there's something so fun about the way they remastered these original series episodes. They just like really richened up the colors. It just looks fucking great.
It really does. This, the few times that we've gone back to the original series, it's been a total delight, for those reasons. It's just a really beautiful looking show, I think.
Yeah. Just like looking at a screen with this many like blocked primary colors on it is fun, you know?
It feels like 50s Christmas, like like the sort of colors you would get during the holidays, and everything's blinking. The way the ship looks when it confronts the object in space, like it's really wonderful to see.
It really is. They are out on a deep space star mapping mission. When they run into a Windows 95 screensaver.
Mm. This was my pick back when I was saddled with a Windows machine.
I never had one. We never had one in the house, so I would just see it on like the computer at on a teacher's desk in high school, and you know you sit there just like hoping to hell that cube would touch the corner of the screen as it bounced around.
It's a real be careful what you wish for moment, because everyone's super bored about taking space pictures ahead of this. And then as if on cue, a thing to break the boredom appears, and it becomes immediately not okay.
It is an object that they really can't wrap their heads around, because they can't divine a purpose for it.
They're all Mac users.
Right. Like, give me a flying toaster. I know what to do, but what the fuck is this thing? They're quite concerned. I mean, it's obviously governed by an intelligence, because it slows down and stops in front of them. But then they try and steer a course around it, and no dice. It's not going to let them do that.
This is a quality to a UFO that we've seen before in Star Trek, though much later. Like, this is Encounter at Farpoint style, inescapable object gameplay happening here, right?
Totally. Yeah, this, I think, establishes the trope, right?
Yeah, and it sort of teases it. Like, you see the star field and it kind of move off of center before moving back into center again. Teases you with the idea that escape is possible, but it is not. The theme to the show is the only escape, and we get Spock eyes to that.
Speaking of theme music, Adam, one thing I really loved in this episode was how whenever they cut back to this cube on the screen, it had its own like super intense, suspenseful music cue.
I could have lived in the exterior shot of this episode for quite a while. And they give you quite a few too, but the remaster just really makes it look cool.
Yeah. I read that this is the first episode that we see Leonard McCoy, first episode we see Lieutenant Uhura, and the first episode that we see Yeoman Rand.
Wow. They got rid of Dr. Old, huh?
I guess so, yeah. They didn't need him for episode 10.
Everyone's still grieving his death.
When we cut down to Six Bay, which is where the captain is, he is doing his annual physical, which involves lying on an inclined table, treading back and forth on this like wall-mounted device with his legs.
I was laughing and laughing at this scene until I thought, and this is how it works when you watch original series Star Trek, I think, until you think about what it took to make. And then I'm like, well, how is he keeping his legs on those pieces of wood without sliding his feet off of them? Like, how is he getting believable pressure back? Like, what's happening behind the wall? My mind was racing with all the practical questions.
There are like a trillion sandbags on the back of this flat so that it doesn't rock back and forth every time he pushes on it with his legs.
And poor Bill Shatner is like, has like practical sweat happening. Yeah. He's really doing it.
That's what you have to do in a physical, right? You have to push yourself a little bit so that the doctor can get some measurements.
You've taken one of those, right? You ever wear the Heart Walkman and then run on the treadmill?
No, you know, we probably talked about it more on The Greatest Generation than on this show, but a few months back I had a heart scare, and I totally thought that they were going to have me do one of those, and they did not.
I was telling you that you were going to do one of those because I had been subjected to one. I was surprised that they didn't.
The like hose that goes into your mouth and everything.
Yeah, I of course had to undergo this procedure during a break from work. So I had to go in there like in my work clothes and run on a treadmill wearing work shoes and like my boxers. Very uncomfortable.
Yeah, a lot of flopping around going on.
Yeah, not good.
My favorite music cue by far is when the captain sees that there's a red alert going on and like is toweling himself off and gets on FaceTime with Spock up on the bridge, and Spock's like, "Get a load of this cube!" And then the camera cuts to the cube on the FaceTime, and we get the cube's theme music.
So great! I love it. This is a bad scene for McCoy, because it's revealed that McCoy saw the red alert status and muted it.
Yeah.
So this blinking light has been going on while Kirk has been pumping away at this wall bike.
The first scene that McCoy is in is kind of setting McCoy up to be like the comic relief of the show, because Kirk walks out and McCoy is blathering on to himself about how if he jumped every time a light came on in Six Bay, he'd be a self-talker.
I feel like if all you've had up until now is Dr. Boyce, and what we've seen from the episodes, the Boyce episodes is what we've called them, you and I,
mm-hmm.
he's got the captain's ear. He's a trusted confidant. He gets a little bit of, he gets a longer leash because of the field that he's in, but he's never like, he's never lying to the captain the way that McCoy just full on begins our experience with him deceiving Captain Kirk. And I really wonder if you're a Star Trek fan at this moment in time, very early on in the series, what you make of McCoy at this point. It doesn't seem like he's very likable either here or in the rest of the episode, really.
Yeah, but it is like a kind of crucial character detail, which is that he knows that Kirk will not come and do this willingly and will find any excuse to get out of it.
He's a for your own good doctor.
Yeah, like he's got him and he's gonna get him through the entire thing before he lets Kirk run out of there and go back to captaining.
which he does almost immediately. Like the emergency requires it. But like shirtless Kirk wearing his uniform around his neck like he's in a Nantucket regatta on his way back to the turbo lift is a look.
Yeah. Kirk is a sweaty man. And he does a lot of like get his shirt in both hands, then place a call, then like start talking to the person while putting his shirt on. This that seems very strategic and practiced.
Yeah, in a let's make this guy the hunk of the show kind of way.
I do want all my coworkers to see my triangle shaped torso.
He's got hunky moves.
Mm-hmm. It's like he doesn't even try, and he does hunky stuff.
I mean, young, virile Captain Kirk, shirtless, in an original series episode is a thing. Great mm-hmm. looking guy.
He's a snack. He can get it.
Yeah, Kirk. I love how Kirk has just enough consideration of other people to be like on the turbo lift, pausing for a moment and going, "Do I have time for a shower? I should probably shower." And then he asks, and the bridge tells him. Like basically repeats the story that he got in Six Bay. And he's like, all right, I got time to change. And what's crazy about how this episode spends its time is that we get the changing scene.
Right.
We get Kirk asking the bridge again for an update to the report. The report, Ben, unchanged.
Yeah,
we're getting exactly the same report.
And it's not them saying unchanged. It's them saying the stuff again.
Yeah. There's such a chill pace to this entire episode, and it teaches you that right away. Like, do not expect for this to be a rush job of a story. We're gonna get an opportunity to just sort of lay back in the cut and experience it.
Everybody's drunk. It's the 60s.
It's not going to energize your adrenal gland, which is a conversation that Bailey has with Spock on the bridge. Lieutenant Bailey has to apologize for raising his voice on the bridge earlier.
Spock does bits on Bailey for having kind of panicked in a touch and go moment.
Right.
You know, Bailey is a character I was unfamiliar with and definitely like makes himself the foreground character in many scenes. And it's partly in the way that the scenes are blocked, right? Like the camera's on that side of the bridge, so he's the closest to the camera a lot of the time when we're in the wide shot.
In the parlance of an improv crew, he is not a generous scene partner, I would say.
This cube is a real puzzle. It seems like a solid mass. It doesn't seem to be, you know, crude in any way. It doesn't answer hails. Doesn't do anything. It just won't let them go.
Right. It's irritating is what it is.
Also irritating is Bailey, like, early and often suggesting that they kill it. And Spock is not the only one that drags Bailey in front of all of his coworkers.
This is going to be a through line for the episode, is people talking about Bailey and how maybe he's not right for the job.
Kirk reminds Bailey that he is not not participating in a democratic structure by being a crew member of the Enterprise.
Boy, we sure see it later on in the briefing room where we get an elliptical edit. They've been just holding in place for 18 hours and
yeah.
And they've started to fray the tensions.
This is hour 17 of an 18-hour McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Where they're like, you know, Pat Buchanan is like pouring himself a cup of coffee. He's had to leave set a couple of times to go to the bathroom. They're all exhausted. They cannot reach an agreement about whether conservatives or liberals are correct.
They're on issue 217. Spock has an idea about what this thing is. It could be one of two things. Either it's a space bois, which would make some sense because it's not communicative in any way. It's just like a space marker.
Yeah.
Or it's flypaper, which is a thing that they might be caught in, a form of a trap.
Right.
And you don't want to stick around for the boss fly if you're caught in flypaper. That's how flypaper works, right?
Yeah. There's an end fly.
Yeah.
After 18 hours, the decision is made. Let's try throwing her in reverse.
Bailey thinks he knows what Kirk is going to say. And what he thinks Kirk is going to say is, shoot it now.
Right.
And Kirk big dogs him in one of the biggest big dog scenes I think we've ever gotten in Star Trek. Like,
yeah.
He jerks his leash super hard.
Kirk makes the Picard big dog seem like a puppy in this episode. When he does big dogging, it is big.
The reverse plan is implemented, and I had a hard time figuring out what exactly was happening in this scene, like because they go to warp in reverse, right?
Well, I think also there is an issue with how they remastered it, and I don't know if this is trying to be faithful to the original episode or a mistake in the remaster, because I was looking for this because I wanted to see if it was in the original, you know, like the originally aired version of the episode as well. But like the star movement continuity is off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it makes it confusing what's going on.
Like we never cut to the exterior, and that's a major obstacle to orienting ourselves to what's happening with the ship. A quick cut to the entrepreneur warping in reverse would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're trying to get out of here, and they cannot get away from the cube, and also it starts spinning faster and faster and getting closer to them, and also emitting radiation that is getting closer and closer to a level where, you know, their shields won't be able to repel it any further.
This is a kind of magic, right? Because this thing looks like the bob on the end of a jester's hat. It's very non-threatening looking.
Yeah.
Just by looking at it.
It kind of looks like the easiest Rubik's Cube in the world.
Right. But let's talk about the ingredients here. We've got proximity changing. It's getting closer, and that's scary no matter how friendly the object looks.
Yeah.
We've got the music change. The music is changing the level of threat.
Yeah. We're going closer and closer in our singles on the actors as we cut around the bridge, and the light cast on their faces is changing in a way that is like, it's very unflattering. And I think that makes you uncomfortable, like seeing all these like extremely beautiful people cast in unflattering light is off-putting.
I bring it up because like this is a challenge for independent filmmakers, and it has been forever, right? How do you make something scary if you don't have a budget?
Mm-hmm.
Like these are the things that are available to you.
Yeah. Anybody can afford a Rubik's Cube.
Anyone can afford a close-up.
So they panic. Like they kind of do what Bailey has been suggesting the entire time and lick a shot at this thing. And it is Fire Phasers 2 commercial.
It sure seems like the crew needs sunglasses more than they need seatbelts, because there's like two things happening, right? Like bangers are getting dropped, but also they're like covering their eyes. This thing is so bright and close.
Yeah. One thing I love about original series is that when a banger gets dropped on the ship, they pretty reliably cut to another part of the ship to show that it's also affecting people there.
I love that. I wish that was something that they kept using in TNG.
Yeah, I think TNG earlier seasons did it a little bit, but eventually they were like, all right, we know that the banger is also hitting the people in the hallway, but like the cast of extras in these hallway bangers, like there's a lot of scenes with bangers in this episode, and there's one scene later on where there are like sustained bangers getting dropped on them, and it's the same people in the hallway every single time, like the same set of costumes. Like, it's very funny. Like, they definitely knocked out the hallway bangers in, like, you know, like, right after lunch, we're going to do all the hallway bangers. Then we're going to go to the scenes on the bridge.
That's a wrap for Hallway Bangers Crew.
We come back from commercial, and the entrepreneur is floating in space, no cube around, and they're looking around. They're not detecting anything coming at them. So now they have to decide, like, is this a part of space we want to keep monkeying around with? Do we want to, you know, do we want to risk running into another cube, or do we want to head back to safer waters? And the decision is made, like, no, I think we should probably keep exploring strange new worlds and new civilizations.
I love how willing this episode is to sit in the moment of this decision. Like, this is an essential science fiction / Star Trek question. Like, do we keep going forward?
Right.
It is dangerous. What happened to us feels like we got away with something. Should we turn back now?
Right.
And I love how this episode doesn't shy away from that idea. And it feels like very few episodes of Star Trek ever do really consider whether or not they should keep going.
That's a thing that they even address in this conversation between Kirk and Spock, because
Spock's like, should we keep going? And Kirk is like, this is Star Trek.
Yeah. Kirk is going to boldly go because that's what Kirk does. But he kind of like bounces the idea off of Spock. And then Spock is like, why do you even ask me, man? Like, you're going to boldly go. You're Kirk.
I like how the recitation of the mission is a great answer to anyone who may be fearful.
Right.
And it's definitely not Spock that's fearful. Spock just wants to know what's going to happen next. But to a person like a Bailey, it matters a great deal. He needs to hear what the mission is to, like, ground him.
Yeah. I thought it was also interesting that Bailey does not get a told you so moment in this scene. Right. Like, instead of Bailey being like, well, I guess I was right about that whole shoot it first, ask questions later thing, Kirk is like, hey, Bailey, your phaser crews suck. Can you fucking whip them into shape now?
Yeah. I remember giving the order to fire and then nothing happening for a very pregnant couple of seconds.
It was like I was trying to podcast on the internet and there was like a lot of lag in between me and the person I was communicating with. And we want to edit those little lag points out of the episode, not waste our listeners' time.
Yeah. Rob would really appreciate that. So Kirk does that thing where he drops the practice bomb on the bridge before leaving.
Yeah.
Like, hey, get it together. Tighten it up, because by the time I get back, I'm going to need it super tight. And then he bails into the turbo lift with McCoy.
Yeah.
Your timing is lousy, Jim.
That's a kind of boss I dread. The kind of boss that's just like, hey, while I'm gone, get way better at your jobs, everyone. Okay, later.
It's such a power move. Get better because you need to get on my level. I don't need to participate in the getting betterness.
Right. I'm already there. You guys need to get up here.
In the turbo lift, McCoy and Kirk have another moment where they talk about Bailey, and McCoy is of the opinion that he was promoted too fast. McCoy's like, you can see it. Everyone else can. Bailey fucking sucks. And you're riding him too hard.
Bailey is like the Peter Principle on The Entrepreneur.
Kirk isn't that manager that's like, you just don't see what I see in Bailey. He's great. And he's going to be great. And he's going to prove it. Like, the dark part of this is that Kirk isn't willing to admit a mistake in promoting Bailey, and is pushing back on McCoy for questioning the decision.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird tension between Kirk's own like pride in self and also the narcissism of minor differences, because McCoy accuses Kirk of promoting him fast because Kirk sees a lot of himself in Bailey.
Right. And I think we see a lot of Kirk and Bailey later on.
We sure do. This also establishes that Kirk and McCoy are old drinking buddies, because they head back to Kirk's quarters and pour themselves something else. I don't know what this is.
It's not what we're drinking.
No, it's definitely not Tranya, but it looks like it kind of comes from like a Bull's cheapo bottle that like triple sec comes in.
It looks like a little bit of a sherry glass though too, right? Up and Little.
Mm-hmm. I like the glass a lot, actually.
Up and Little is my call sign.
What are you going to do with that 6% when they give it to you, Jim?
So they're hanging out.
Kirk is like, you mind if I eat?
It's not even Kirk. It's Yeoman Rand comes in and says, you better put something in your face because you haven't in a while. And turns out that the computer has been changed and he's now forced to eat dietary salad because of a decision that the doctor made.
How much more unpleasant than salad is dietary salad, I wonder? I like a salad, but yeah. Boy, if you're putting guardrails on the salad for nutritional reasons, for dietary reasons, it does not look enjoyable.
That salad looked rough. It did not look well-dressed, and it didn't look like it had much of a variety to it.
Right. I think Kirk is a little more interested in eating Yeoman Rand than, than he is in the salad, TBH.
This salad is not so interesting to me as that deli platter.
Right. You can tell right away that there's a spark here.
Yeah. And he calls it out. He says, like, I can't believe Starfleet Command put a snack like that on my yeoman duty.
Yeah, things are really changing around Starfleet.
They know about my appetite.
Not to mention the strange black woman they put on my bridge. I mean, what's up with that?
He can't quite plow through this salad the way he would like to plow through Yeoman Rand, because they get an urgent message from the bridge that they're picking up another contact on radar. And this thing is way bigger than the cube ever was. So he throws his napkin down on top of his dietary salad and they rush up to the bridge. Bigger, greater energy reading. And we see this thing on screen, and it's this giant sphere covered in like Christmas lights. And by the time they're nose to nose with this thing, it's obvious that it is like a zillion times bigger than the Entrepreneur. It's it fills up the screen, Adam.
They did a great job with the sense of scale with this thing.
Yeah.
And like every other remastering in this episode, it looks great.
Yeah, because Hulu used to have the unremastered original series, and I guess at some point they changed it to the HD version. And that was such a great resource to like go back and look at what it used to look like.
Yeah.
We don't have that anymore. I guess I probably could have looked on YouTube. I bet this stuff is all on YouTube.
I was able to compare stills, and mm-hmm. stills gave you a good idea of the differences, but wow. I mean, to the extent that there are even differences, that's how much better this is.
Yeah. Looks dope. This is a thing that they are trying to communicate with and not getting anything back initially.
Until finally they do. It's coming in through the navigation beam. That's the problem. Like the hailing frequency gets nothing. But Bailey is like, hey guys, the nav beam has got a message. How about we listen to it? When they do, it's
Baylock.
And his ship is called the Fisarius.
And then we cut to David Letterman up on the stage and he introduces them. Bailey, Baylock, Baylock, Bailey. And it really does not go over well. And David Letterman never gets invited back to host Star Trek, the original series.
Baylock is pissed, and rightly so, because the Entrepreneur destroyed their warning buoy and just continued on like it was nothing.
What's up, shitheads? It's me, your boy, the number one warning boy. The number one warning boy.
All you gotta do is trust me.
Anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is like extremely frustrating to them, because like this thing is doing all the procedures wrong. Like it's talking to them through navigation, it's not giving them the face to face like they like with the FaceTime. And it's very threatening.
I really like the science fiction of misunderstanding. And this is an episode that really makes that the core of the conflict.
Yeah.
Like they didn't know what they did back there. They didn't know how serious of an offense it was and how it would be taken. And it seems like one of the main kinds of stories that should and could be told in science fiction.
Right.
Because when you oppose two different cultures that are totally alien to each other, misunderstanding should be the most frequent kind of conflict.
Yeah. It really reminds me of that TNG scene where Troy is in the ready room and she like holds up a cup of tea in front of Picard and says, like, when I say like a word for this, you might interpret it as hot, you might interpret it as brown, you might interpret it as wet. And like the way that you see the world and the way I see the world, we know to be very similar, but like we're going to be communicating with an alien species that might conceive of the world in totally different ways that we can't imagine. And this is like an early version of that kind of story. And they cannot convince Baylock that like this was an honest mistake, like that this happened in good faith. They tried to get away from this thing. They weren't here to mess about, and they destroyed it because it seemed like the only way they could survive their encounter with it.
Bailey is becoming a huge liability here because he cannot, if he is doing a thing, he's doing that thing late.
Yeah.
And the next thing they try to do is like, all right, well, this is a scandal and a bad thing we're involved in. Let's go send a warning marker out so other ships avoid the area. And this is a thing that the Fasarius destroys right away.
Yeah.
And Bailey could barely get it together enough to even send this thing out.
Recorder marker is a good idea. I would love that to be just like kind of routine,
right,
like bridge banter in any situation where a starship is about to head into something that might be dangerous.
I agree. And it's so rarely used that way.
Yeah.
It's at this point that the Fasarius is like, look, not only are we not going to allow you to communicate with anyone else, but this is a death sentence. You have 10 minutes to pray to whatever deity that we know you to have, because one of the things that the Fasarius does is scan the ship and it reads all of its logs and computer databases. Like, it's got a pretty good grasp of the capabilities over there.
What Spock devotes himself to in this 10 minutes is, what do these guys look like? Let's see if we can get them on screen.
There's like 3 minutes here that are unintentionally funny.
Yeah.
Because what Spock chooses to do is hilarious. The Kirk face that he makes when he realizes that the Fasarius's message has been transmitted to the rest of the ship, and he's got to be like, all right, I better follow up with a message of my own, is awesome.
Yeah.
He improvises a really great message to the rest of the ship, like on the heels of the Fasarius message, which is great. But it feels like Kirk and the rest of the crew are on their heels just entirely. It's great.
Yeah.
It's great to see them play from this far back.
When they get Baylock on the screen, Baylock is a extremely janky puppet man.
I was curious to see how they appeared.
This is a thing you see in all the Halloween stores that no one has ever bought. In the history of Halloween, no one has ever bought the waiter. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
The waiter monster with the tray.
Yeah.
That's what Baylock looks like to me.
Yeah. I think the thing that's sad about Baylock is that Baylock is presenting himself as being like this exquisitely advanced intelligence that is, you know, considers them to be but an ant that he's about to crush because they blew up his bois. And yet Baylock is chiming in every 60 seconds with, you now have 7 of your Earth minutes.
Yeah, he's not doing himself any favors.
It's not really like lending any credibility to his claims.
He should switch to text. I think that would help him.
Yeah. No relationship has ever been improved by switch to text, but this one might.
That's what I'm saying. Like, normally, if you feel an argument heating up, you want to get out of text. Yeah. You want to switch to voice or in person.
Yeah. You want face to face. You want to de-escalate.
Right.
Bailey basically, you know, has his second like big blow up in this period where he's like, are you guys fucking nuts? Like, we're all gonna die and you're just sitting around like puzzling through and trying to figure out how we can get Baylock on the screen and shit? This is nuts.
it's crazy how well Starfleet Academy has screened out "We're All Gonna Die" guy. Like, in the history of Starfleet, you get him so rarely.
Yeah, yeah.
And here is Bailey.
Yeah.
Like, ready to be that.
The first and last "We're All Gonna Die" guy in Star Trek history. He has to get escorted off the bridge by the doctor.
It's got to hurt Dr. McCoy to do this because, like, he saw this coming.
Yeah.
He warned Kirk.
Anybody that we get, like, the close-up to in this moment does that, like you hate to see it face.
I love when Bailey loses it. He's doing such a Bill Shatner as Captain Kirk impression that it's like, you can tell that his, like, what he does here is the thing that made him the star of Starfleet Academy improv. Like, there's almost an impressed feeling around the crew watching this happen.
Yeah.
You can't tell if Bailey's more in trouble for breaking down or just doing an impression of Captain Kirk here.
It's the end of everything. What are you, robots?
Baylock is not listening to reason. Kirk is trying to say, like, listen, man, you've scanned all the tapes on our tape-driven computer system. You know that we were just trying to get away from that thing. This is a simple misunderstanding. Like, can we come to some agreement on that at least? I love the line from Baylock, "We grow annoyed of your foolishness." That's a mood. That's something I'm gonna use on shitty internet comments going forward.
Yeah. Put that in the back pocket.
Yeah. Very impressed with Baylock's just like total disregard for Kirk trying to reason with him there.
This episode basks in the amount of time left as a warning and lets you sit in it almost dialogue free for the next long while, I feel like, in a way that I thought was like, I feel like the episode was trying to increase tension with this. But as a modern viewer, I was most impressed with how willing it was to just like sit back.
Let you do the tension yourself, basically.
Yeah. You're jacking yourself off during this. The show's not doing anything. The show is watching you what's happening in this moment.
The show likes to watch.
I loved it.
It never telegraphs like how we're gonna get out of this. Cause like Kirk comes up with a pretty good idea, which is this is poker, not chess. But like, even when Spock suggests they're in checkmate, you don't get the poker thing. Like, Kirk turns that around in like the last minute that they're there.
Right.
And it turns out to work. Like, the title of the episode, the Corbomite maneuver, is that Kirk says, oh yeah, this ship is actually riddled with Corbomite. And it's a device where if you shoot us, the ship will reflect an equal ray back at you. And it's never not worked in 200 years. So we don't encode that into the computers. We wouldn't want an entity like you to get that secret. So you're just going to have to trust me on that, buddy.
Corbomite is a very rubber V glue technology.
And it works. The timer runs out, and there are those pregnant moments afterwards where they're waiting for the sword of Damocles to fall on their heads, and it doesn't.
It's clench and release. It's great.
I love that clench and release.
I love how the timer winds down. There are moments of just nothing, like post-timer.
Yeah.
They're like, what's going to happen? And then Baylock gets on the blower and he's like, we're going to put like a 5-minute break here. We're just going to take a break. We're going to figure this out. But while we're thinking, we want to see the schematics on the Corbomite device.
Yeah.
If you please.
That's not something we released to the public. Sorry, buddy. No can do.
This is classic Kirk. Classic Kirk is don't answer the hail right away.
Mm-hmm.
Classic Kirk is when he finally answers the hail, denying the request. He's got the leverage back.
Yeah. You wait for me.
Kirk starts taking off his tunic and tying it around his neck. Like, it's time to get a little shirtless here, boys. I'm starting to feel hot.
A little sweaty under the collar.
Could anyone go for any coffee? Is an unasked question. An unasked question that Yeoman Rand answers with her appearance on the bridge.
Yeah, shows up with some phaser coffee that she made because everything else is broken.
It's sort of a, like a phaser arrow press situation that, that Yeoman Ray admits to. We know that they keep firearms in the galley of starships.
We know this from Undiscovered Country.
Yeah.
Do you think she filled the arrow press with grounds and then poured some hot water over top and was letting it steep and then had it positioned over the cup and just fired a phaser that caused the arrow press to disappear but the coffee to fall into the cup?
They installed the alarm technology much later, though, because as Star Trek VI taught us, no one can shoot an unauthorized phaser aboard a starship.
Well, maybe that's one of the systems that Baylock knocked out.
Maybe so. Yeah. Baylock has a plan.
Yeah, he's going to give him a tow. They're going to go have to live the rest of their lives on a planet he has selected for them. And he's not going to do it with his big fancy ship. He's going to send a little tow ship to do it. And this is a third kind of starship that we're introduced to. It's not the cube. It's not the giant sphere. It's just a small collection of the little glowing orbs that make up the sphere.
Did this inspire Kirk's punishment of Khan, do you think?
Oh, interesting.
The whole, like, you're not going to kill us. You're instead going to tow us to a planet and destroy our ship after we're beamed down.
Yeah, we're going to leave you at this great place. It's called SETI Alpha 5. You're going to love it.
I wonder. Kirk has a long memory. I love how Baylock is very self-conscious about the size of his vessel. Like, as soon as this little speck pops off, Baylock is like, it is a grower and not a shower. Also, it is very cold in space. Why else do you think they serve revenge there? Revenge, famously the coldest of dishes.
Honestly, there has been more shrinkage than I would like. So they're getting towed, and they start to do the math. They're like, this is a small ship. Like, its power production can only be so much. So maybe we could actually break away from the tractor beam that's on us now in a way that we couldn't before. And so they're going to try this. And this is like a very long sequence of them just like slowly increasing how much resistance they're putting on this tractor beam, trying to like kind of shoot off it and at a right angle to the direction they're getting pulled. And straining their engines to the breaking point where, you know, we're watching all the little meters go, you know, past 11 on the consoles. We're watching the crew down in the hallways bang back and forth against the walls, you know, getting Spock telling us that we're, you know, 2,000 degrees over engine tolerances and stuff like that.
Again, like this seems like a classic kind of science fiction thing. Like, you have great power, but you can only use very little of it, or you risk burning out the system that makes it possible, right?
Yeah. And it seems like this, the amount of power that they have is like the perfect amount, because they push their ship basically as hard as it can go to break free. They watch all the lights on Baylock's tow ship grow more and more intense, and then, like, you know, right at the point where they would have to decide, okay, shut it down, this didn't work, it works, and they break away, and then they're like, well, okay, like, we should probably just like run as fast as we can now, except for we just fucking shredded our engine doing that.
I like the forcing function of this. Like, in any other circumstance, you know, they would peace out.
Yeah,
but they can't, so they decide to linger. What they've learned by Baylock's ship's distress signal is that its engines are out and its life support is failing.
Right. They hear a distress call that's going from the tow ship back to the mothership. And Kirk is like, all right, we got to help. And everybody's like, what? And he's like, you heard the opening. Seek out new life and new civilization. Like, we boldly went and now we're going to seek out the new life. You know, like, we got to do the right thing by these guys.
Kirk extends a finger to the view screen. He's like, there might be something worth fucking over there.
Look at those round, supple orbs.
You asked me if there was anything in space worth fucking. Well, there it sits.
So they're going to beam over. He's going to bring two people. He's like, all right, the doctor and who else? Who else? Who has made this episode all about themselves? All right, Lieutenant Bailey.
Hair Trigger Bailey.
Wants Bailey to look into the face of the unknown. He owes him that.
In the transporter room, Scotty distributes the away team fanny sash that they hang their gear onto, which is great. And then they do a beam over, bent over.
Yeah, because it's like a shorter ship than the Entrepreneur is. They have lower ceilings.
Why did this never happen again?
I know.
People, like, the idea of crouching even isn't a quality of beaming over to other ships the way it should be.
Yeah, we've seen a couple of times where they beam out where, like, everybody's facing outward with their gun up.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, the idea of crouching is really fun. And they beam over, yeah, and they are indeed, like, 6 inches, heads are 6 inches from the ceiling because it is a very short space. And they walk in and they find the head of Baylock. And it is indeed a janky puppet, Adam.
It is Baylock holding a server's tray. Kirk mentions, like, no one ever buys that thing at the Halloween store.
Yeah, it's like, why do they even put it in the store? Because it's not like, it doesn't really make you want to buy anything. It's not like something anyone is interested in, but it's like somehow part of the merchandising of a Halloween store all the time.
It feels like if you run on a Halloween store, you need a premium item,
yeah,
something with a high dollar value, and yet no one wants to spend $500 on Monster Waiter.
Yeah,
that's an extravagance no one is willing to pay for.
Yeah, why would you?
And clearly, neither has Baylock invested much in this puppet
or in his costume, because the curtain goes up and the Wizard of Oz is revealed. It is 6-year-old Clint Howard.
Yeah, apolitical Clint Howard is what we get here, which means we can like him.
Yeah, this is Clint Howard before he was a shithead.
Little 6-year-old Clint Howard has the eyebrows of a Philip Baker Hall, though. Just giant eyebrow game, which is great. I think if you're a makeup person in this era, you want the eyebrows to cover the bald cap. And I think you get the benefit of that here.
Yeah. I read that the makeup director on this episode wanted to bick Clint Howard's head. And his dad was like, no fucking way. So they did the bald cap. But the eyebrows were a great touch to kind of, like, carry the effect across. My wife was in the room when I was watching this episode, and I was like, get a load of 6-year-old Clint Howard here. And she was like, he looks exactly the same.
One of the things I really like about this episode is that doubling down of misunderstanding, right? Like, the misunderstanding of blowing up a bois, mm-hmm, led to the conflict with Baylock later on. And now, according to Baylock, the test is over. It's time for drinks. Chill out on my drinking couch and play some catch up with me. But the thing is, it's too soon. It's too soon for Kirk and Bailey. They're reluctant to have the drink when the Tranya is produced. They think it's another trap. And I love how the rules are different between these two aliens, right? According to Baylock, the testing is over. It's time for hangs.
Yeah.
But the memory is a lot longer for Kirk.
It's interesting, this, like, for as many scenes that just lingered in a moment of tension early in this episode, mm-hmm, this scene goes so fast. And yeah, it asks us to suspend disbelief about some stuff really quickly. Like, it's like, yeah, like, we're gonna sit here and, like, chill with this dude who is explaining to us that he was testing us and we passed the test. And, like, now we can ask him all the questions we want and also, like, leave an officer as part of, like, a newly established exchange program between our two peoples. And they're like, wait a second, like, we just felt like we were about to die, like, 30 seconds ago.
I love how basically they're still having this conversation when the credits roll.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
They are hammering out details of diplomatic shit between their people, and these are, like, you know, the first, you know, 15 sentences exchanged between Baylock and them.
I love how this is a mutually agreeable situation because Bailey isn't happy working for Kirk. Kirk isn't happy having Bailey on his bridge.
Yeah.
Baylock is like, well, I'd like to keep one of you around. Which one is it going to be? Like, it's a perfect solution to this problem.
Yeah. And I love when Baylock is like, cool. So Bailey is like the ideal human. And everybody's like, no, far from it. Far from it.
He's gonna want to shoot a lot of things while he's over here. He's sort of the first Wesley and Traveler situation, right? Like the way that they sort of dropped Wesley off with the Traveler and they did that pretty fast. Feels like the same thing is in play here.
Yeah. Well, did you like the Corbomite maneuver, Adam?
I loved it, is what I did, Ben. This was great. This was a real delight.
Yeah.
You look up the Corbomite maneuver and you see the fucking picture of the Halloween store waiter and you're like, this is going to suck dick. It's going to be the worst episode. Like, how could we do this to ourselves?
Yeah.
But the episode is great. And that's because it's great science fiction. Like, I feel like great science fiction supersedes science fiction effects.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, classic Outer Limits was able to do, right?
Sure, sure.
It exceeded because the story was so strong in spite of itself. And I feel like that's what happened with this episode. I think the one big takeaway I'm going to get from this is how much of this episode was spent in silence, just thinking about the next move, whether it was during the countdown or post-countdown when they were being towed.
Yeah.
The respect that the episode gives you as a viewer to just kind of sit in it. And like think about what might happen next with the crew. You don't get that ever with modern television at all. And I loved it. I loved how unique it felt to go back and do that and experience a story the way that we did. Loved it. What about you?
I did too. You know, there's something to be said for fancy production set pieces. And we sure get a lot of them in Star Trek Picard and Star Trek Discovery. But I totally agree. Like, it's like a Dr. Dre beat, this episode. Like, there's like big, long gaps between the bass and the snare, and they are a part of the beat, you know, and it fucking slaps.
Which one is my camera? Is it? Okay, I see the camera. No other Star Trek show is going to compare an original series episode with a Dr. Dre beat besides Greatest Discovery. Nicely done, Ben.
Yeah. Do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages?
Yeah, I'm on my way there right now.
Okay.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first Priority One message is from Dingman. It is to COVID-19.
Wow. COVID-19, big fan of the show.
Yeah.
Loyal listener.
Oddly, like one of our biggest financial supporters. I mean, thank you, but also, I mean, no thank you. The message goes like this. The sheer fucking hubris. And that's the end of the message.
Good times.
I'm with you, Dingman. I do not enjoy the hubris of this COVID-19.
When you fill out the form on MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, you have an opportunity to request a date, which is not guaranteed by any means. But if you've got like a date that you're shooting for, you can try for it. And if they can't accommodate you on the calendar, they will. And what Dingman requested was ASAP, while we're all in quarantine, shit, that'll probably be a while.
Dingman had no idea just how evergreen his message would be, I think. Thanks, Dingman. I think you're saying what everyone is thinking.
Yeah. Our second P1 is from Ryan from Sacramento, and it's for Ben and Adam. And it goes like this. Greetings from NorCal in this time of plague. I wish this could be one of those P1s where I drop cool inside jokes to my friends, but let's just say that maybe I appreciate your podcast because they're helping me through all the work I'm doing instead of making them. Thanks again for all you do. More TOS in the off season? Just a thought.
Oh, Ryan from Sacramento gets it.
Yeah, Ryan really nailed it this time.
We might be doing a lot of TOS, given how we still don't know when Discovery is coming back.
That's true. Well, we'll have to make a decision about that eventually. But in the meantime, you can support our program by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron and getting a Priority One message. It's $100 for a personal message or $200 for a commercial message. It's not the only way to support, but it's one we sure appreciate.
We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that, being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second and go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself a Edward Larkin?
I did. I'm going to give it to Yeoman Rand for her phaser coffee. I just, like, I wrote down in my notes, like, Yeoman Rand does not give a fuck, because she walks onto the ridge like she's there to cut the tension. Like, I can see why she's there from a story standpoint, but from a being a yeoman standpoint, it's like, yeesh, pick a moment other than this.
There are people on the bridge who are full on wearing the eye mask that says, do not wake me for beverage service. Yeoman Rand just charges right through that.
Yeah. Sir, it's time to get up. Did you have an Edward Larkin, Adam?
It's really hard to choose between Bailey and McCoy. Bailey for the improv scene that he does.
Yeah.
At Kirk. And McCoy for lying about the red alert. I feel like the Bailey scene is more fun to me. So I'm going to go with Bailey of the two sides of that coin.
Yeah.
And plus, we're never going to see Bailey again. So
yeah.
I like to give my Edward Larkins to those who may not ever get the chance.
Fair. I'm into it.
Well, we need to get into what we might do in a couple of weeks, Ben. Do you have any ideas?
Boy, tough call. I mean, we could always do more TOS.
I think that would be my vote.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah, we saw that old Romulan warship in Star Trek Picard, and it made me wonder more about the origins of the Romulans. Maybe we should research some of their deal. And it looks like Balance of Terror would be a good original series episode with which to do that.
So season 1, episode 14 of the original series will be the next thing we cover on this show.
Fun.
Come back in a couple of weeks for that, and then we'll leave it with Rob's from here.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison. The show is produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is produced by Friend of DeSoto and YouTube sensation Adam Ragusea. The Greatest Discovery is a podcast that's made possible by the support of listeners like you. To make sure that we continue to make episodes, visit MaximumFun.org/join and pledge your support. By doing so, you'll gain access to all of the Maximum Fun bonus content, including our bonus episodes. If you want to chat about the show on various forms of social media, just search for our discussion groups or use the hashtag GreatestDiscovery. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR. Adam's found at Cut for Time. And I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Thanks.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.